Next Chapter Podcasts.
Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Next Chapter Podcasts.
Welcome back to How I Got Greenlit.
I'm Ryan Gibson, joined by Alex Collegian. Today we have Tony Jasiminski with us, screenwriter.
Producer.
Director.
Novelist. Keep going.
Triple, quadruple threat.
Novelist, playwright.
And my first podcast, too.
Podcast virgin.
Wait, I wasn't done. Tarantula Hawk head cheerleader.
Oh, yeah.
From the Boca Raton Tarantula Hawks.
10,000 people just shut off.
If we were there at 10,000, Tony.
That's a real thing,
I would be happy to have them shut it off.
I'm Alex Collegian, creator of Project Greenlight and many other things you've never heard of. So Tony and I, thank you for coming on, Tony.
Yeah, it's a maiden voyage. I'm very honored. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Our backstory is we both went to NYU Film School, met in film school. Tony was in the writing program. I was in the production program. I'll let you take it from there, but we go way back. And we're still standing.
Well, I'll give you the short version. Alex and I definitely met at NYU. I was in dramatic writing. Had a lot of good years there, too. But I think everybody back then was sort of writing plays. So, the screenwriting department is very small back then. Now I think there's like 2,000 kids in the DWP. But... I graduated there. Then I was in the wilderness for a few years in retail. And then thank God for the Nichols. I won the Nichol Fellowship after submitting about 8 scripts in the last 8 years. And God bless Greg Beale and Joan and the whole gang there. It's a wonderful competition. And that's kind of what broke me in a way.
And for anybody who's interested, and I assume some of you are, the Nichols Fellowship is one of the most prestigious writing contests that you can win in entertainment. And in our show notes, you will have a link to that. Okay, so Tony, what I love about that whole story up to now is the shit job before...
the world of Lauren Taylor, the wonderful world of Lauren Taylor.
Which does it exist anymore?
They died last week.
Yeah.
They actually did die.
So, Tony, you outlived them. Remember that time you were in the stock room and you like, one day, motherfuckers.
Yeah. Well, all the writers listening right now realize we all talk to ourselves on the street and in storerooms. So, yeah, one day it's going to happen. <That's right.
laughs> We grit our teeth while we're talking to Karen asking for the extra large.
Yeah.
Now, Tony, this is an odd left field question, but I think it's important for people to know, for honesty's sake. You knew a bunch of people, obviously, in school. What's the percentage that made it out of Lord and Taylor?
Are we saying NYU or Lord and Taylor? I don't know. I mean,
that's an even better. By the way, that is a better question.
Yeah. A lot of people in retail, they were very creative people. And they went on to different things and their different venues. So I give them props for that. Look. I mean, my whole story is like I had to stay in New York. Because I couldn't go back to Florida because there wasn't a business there. I was in debt. I couldn't go to LA. So I stayed in New York, and retail was the job that you can you know, get hired within a couple of days and try to make a living if you live in Jersey City. So, but, doing that, it's like there's a cliche and there's a reality about like shit work makes you dream better, you know? And I think, Alex, somebody wants to tell us, always stay hungry, you know? And like the money comes and the money goes, but I always see ourselves in the wilderness. And that's how I've always kind of lived my career in a way. I'm glad for the times, I was struggling because it sucks, but it definitely like gives you time to contemplate your stories and your ideas and go from there.
Character builder.
Well, definitely, no pun intended, but also there's a sense of verisimilitude that you don't get from somebody who just straight goes from to film school into making a video, making a commercial, making their first feature.
Yeah.
They haven't lived life, and all their references are from other movies, right? I mean, we've seen it a million times. I also think that you have a deep sense of, or profound sense of gratitude. Your attitude about the whole business is very healthy. You never once act like, you're entitled to anything. You're very grateful for every opportunity you get. And you're very grounded about it because you know that it could go away tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't think it's a realization thing. I think it's just in the moment. It's like, I'm stoked every time on a movie set. You know, I mean, I'm a kid in a candy store. You never get sold for me. The meetings sometimes get a little old and you know, the Fiji water bottle kind of thing. But that's sort of going away now. Now we have the Zooms of the world. But I'm still think this is I'll always think this is just this sort of a wonderful business, and
so the meetings get the same, but isn't there a little thrill from going on a lot, like just like
there always lot? Is it's like you go to Paramount lot and it just feels like every day is the first day you've ever stepped on this lot, just me talking. That's producers that we've had conversations and stuff. It's like you're perpetually like a 16-year-old kid when you go to a movie studio, I think. And I really don't, maybe the music industry, but it's really hard to find another business where you just feel you have this ridiculous smile on your face when you come into like a movie studio.
I think from personal experience.
Also cults.
That's right.
And I also think that, from experience, Alec, we can all speak from experience being on set. I think everyone to a person feels that exact same way when they first come on any new set, no matter how long the hours are, because they are very long.
Yeah, absolutely. And like there could be a whole another hour segment of just about like making movies, but it really feels like summer camp, right, guys? I mean, you go there and you meet people, there's gossip, some people hook up, some people don't, and you all leave each other. You hardly ever see each other again until like you have a next show or something. And
Yeah. Well, who called it high school with money? Somebody? Back to the stock room. So, just let everybody just close your eyes and picture Tony in the 90s wearing.
We'll have a link to his picture in the 90s.
Wearing Chandler Bing outfit on rollerblades, blading to a giant department store. So you were on a typewriter, though. So just to go back.
Yeah, well, it was an electric typewriter. It wasn't like the old school Hemingway thing.
No, but I mean, come on. It was classic. So guys, this picture, it was like the only thing missing was like hayseed in the back of his ears. He had a hand, one of those it was like a Brother or something, one of those old typewriters with a handle on it.
Still cool.
The hard shell case on the
Yes, and you pop it off, and then he slept on a mattress. I mean, you want to talk about, I mean, that's like a French poet level of like an artist.
Yeah, that's what you do when you're 21 years old.
So the Nichols, as we said, was a very is a very prestigious award. Did you get it on your first try, or how did that work?
No, I mean, like I submitted 8 scripts. We talked about this once before. Like I would get letters back from Greg and the gang about making the quarterfinals, but he would have these little notes next to the form letters about, I really thought the script was riveting. Keep going, And it's funny because you tend to throw those ideas away, but he would have these little notes next to the form letters about, I really thought the script was riveting. Keep going, you know. And it's funny because you tend to throw those ideas away, but when you see little sentences and notes like that, it does make you keep going. Like, you know, I went and had a tequila after like I read that, because I'm like, oh, well, somebody actually read my script, you know, with the $30 I sent in, but kind of liked it. I couldn't tell if I had a shot in the business, but I didn't know what else to do, you know, because that's all I would do is write and do retail. And it was going to go one direction. I was going to be a buyer for, you know, Saks, which would have been a good job, and I could have gone somewhere else from there, or I would have stuck to my guns and been a writer. And I guess it's a long way of saying, like, those little notes that they put into the letters sort of got me going. So in the eighth time, I finally won with a horror script, which I don't think the Nichols ever had a horror movie win, which was called Interstate, which is a bit of a road movie. But that was really, you know, humbling for me that, you know, a horror film kind of made it in, because I've always been born and bred on horror movies and thrillers. And I was just really extremely, overjoyed, I guess is the only word I can say, that I not only got into the Nichols, but a horror script got into too. And that's sort of what launched the career, so to speak.
I love that script, by the way. I believe that it's been in development since then, right?
Yeah. John Landis once said he wrote, you know, American Wolf in London when he was still trying to like sell scripts. And that was the first thing that sold, but it never sold big, but he kept getting reoptioned. And he kept getting knocks on his door from it. And it was the same thing with this script. It's getting close to finally getting made after all these years, but it's always the script that never stops giving, you know. And that's one advice I can give anybody who wants my advice, is like, don't be worried if your script doesn't sell for a big spec price or a price in general. If it's optioned, sooner or later, like, real people and good people and talented people who actually want to make a movie will option money for your script, and they'll continue to pay you, you know, for a few years, and it can kind of keep you going. And that's a good example of a movie that's always sort of, you know, a script I wrote back in the day, but it really kept me going his first 10 years.
And just to be clear, Tony, that we're talking, the script has been optioned and optioned again for over.
Yes, it's had multiple options. I don't think it's ever outright sold to a studio, but it was always an indie horror film. So, you know, there was always a producer and a general producer out there who's like, I'm serious about trying to get this going. And they pony up with a certain amount of money that, you know, makes it legit. And, you know, it makes me, you know, it gives me confidence in the industry that outside of the gates of studios, there are still people that are on, you know, their computers and phones and Starbucks that are working their asses off to actually get somebody's movie going. So that's another part of Hollywood that people don't talk about.
Yeah, I think it's good for everyone to know. So moving forward, what was, and Alex, I think you were trying to get to this, is like, what was his first big, what was the greenlit moment, right?
That's a huge one. I'm assuming that, you know, I mean, take us through the process, but I know that the part of the function of the Nichols is to introduce you to agents and managers, right?
Yeah, well, the Nichols gives you a stipend of a certain amount of money, provided that you write the script for a year, you know, and I think you get increments of the money every quarter. But who doesn't want to write when they want a contest for writing a script? You know, I mean, I was very fortunate. Look, I went to Warner Brothers a week after winning the Nichols because I hooked up with great people and good managers and agents, and they brought me into rooms, and I sold a pitch to the wonderful Rennie Harlan back in the day. And I went from there to, you know, big studio projects. But I also know that there's a lot of Nichols winners out there that are more geared to the independent side of cinema, and the Nichols has facilitated their careers, and they still can make the movies they want to make. I mean, I was never a person who wants to direct my next film. I was always a screenwriter 100%. There's a lot of people that won the Nichols that, you know, wanted to really get into the process of directing. And it's also launched a lot of careers for great directors too, for writers, directors. But, you know, my whole thing to go into this was to get into the business, and the Nichols definitely got me into the rooms. And from there, I think it was my Nichols weekend coming out there and accepting the awards. I actually happened upon, you know, selling a spec, and I got into the business from there. And, you know, it really is about sort of make your own, you know. I mean, this Hal Cantor, this wonderful comedian at the Nichols, once said, you know, congratulations, but don't pat yourself on the back too much. It's like, you know, you just stepped out of oblivion into obscurity. And I think everybody's like, I mean, what I took from that is like, congratulations, you know, you're through the gates now. Now it's what you make of it. It is your own. And a lot of people,
the work is just beginning.
That's right. But that's also exciting for somebody who wants to get into, you know, the career of screenwriting or filmmaking or what have you. But the fact is, you're always in the wilderness. You're always in the wilderness.
Yeah, that's totally true. And you're a hero today and a donkey the next. I mean, that's the good and bad of it. But okay, so I think that's, I mean, that's been, I don't have a list, but some of the Nichols winners and runner-ups are sort of a who's who of writers in Hollywood. So that's certainly a great way to do it. I don't know. I mean, when we were in film school, we were kind of two minds. I mean, I think the friends that we made there, I mean, including you, are some of my best friends in my life. On the other hand, I think after like a semester or a year, we were like, let's go make our own movie, man. Do you remember that? You wrote your first script, and we tried to produce it, and we got Ethan Hawke and Nancy Tannenbaum, the producer of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and we were going for it. But
what happened with
everybody's
this?
Making independent movies back then? So it's like,
yeah, so
in New York,
yeah. So yeah. So right. So the,
you got to tell the story
well,
now.
Okay, okay. It was like 1991 or two. Tony was an intern for Nancy Tannenbaum, who at that time was like one of the, you know, like royalty of independent films. She did Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and discovered Soderbergh, discovered Greg Mottola, all these very great directors. And she took a shine to Tony. And so he showed her his first script that he wrote was sort of loosely based on our lives, called Village Idiots. And it was about living in the West Village. And, got it to her. She liked it. I don't know how we, I guess we just asked because we were sort of ballsy, and we just said, we want to make this movie with you, Nancy. And she's like, okay, you gotta raise money first. So I'm going to get you with Sheila Jaffe and George Ann Walken, the biggest casting directors in New York, which they really were. They would end up doing The Sopranos and just everything else. They're still working, you know, all the time. And they were nice enough to take us on, and they got us a incredible group of young New York actors, including Ethan Hawke, who lived in the neighborhood and could relate. He actually, we lived on Waverly and he lived on Waverly, and it was just a occurrence of events. Yeah. And he was great. And we did this reading in the NYU, like some studio, and we took it over and had a bunch of producers and investors and did the whole run. And I remember everybody was into it, and we even had a party at Webster Hall, and we were on our way. And then I don't know.
You guys were celebrating?
We were like trying to hustle like investors and producers.
Oh, you had a party to raise money?
Yes.
Oh, I see what
including you're saying. Like Jason Blum.
Right.
Who was then like, you know, third schmuck from the left at Miramax. I mean, all kinds of people who are still around today. But I forget how we found out, but Ethan Hawke turned to one of us. It might have been me. Maybe I blanked it out. And he's like, you know, I really like you guys and I really like your script, but it's very similar to something that I just got last week that I committed to. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, it's this thing called Reality Bites.
Hello, you've reached the winter of our discontent.
I'm making this documentary about my friends, but it's really about people who are trying to find their own identity without having any real role models or heroes or anything.
And it seems like your friends would be perfect for that.
It's kind of about Gen X kids and like trying to figure themselves out and whatever. And yours is sort of like the New York version of that. So
yeah, I mean, in like 5,000 young kids were writing Gen X scripts at the time too. So
yeah. So, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda.
You should have said it in California.
It's just funny how
that's a perfect example of a moment that's worth, you know, its weight in gold. It's like, okay, yeah. You actually had these producers, you had, you know.
And we were 20.
Yeah.
And we were literally, you know, 20.
Sometimes there's power in the naivety. Naivety. You're not smart enough to where you realize you shouldn't say this. And I think I always admire young people for that one, the fact when they just want to throw something out, because if you arrogantly refuse to do anything else because you want to follow your passion, you're going to do it sooner or later, you know? And I was very happy that we had that night, you know, and I wasn't sure. First of all, I didn't think the script was probably strong enough to get us to the next level. It could have done like a pass. That's my bad. But I also think that, you know, there's always a reason for everything. And it was a step in the right direction. And that's a moment that you're always going to have. And a lot of people that are listening to this, you know, they've already had that moment. They're going to have that moment. So you have to treasure those moments because they're all building blocks into like the greater picture of everything.
And it's what you said about validation, right? You got that letter from the Nichols, who see, let's say conservatively, thousands of scripts a year. And they took the time that, you know, these individuals took the time to write to you and say, it's good, keep going. You didn't win.
Absolutely. And there's like, we're going to, you know, talk about Spielberg in a few minutes, but the idea is like, even these guys, when they were kids, they needed validation to get them sort of moving forward. And that's a generational thing. That's never going to end. It's a community of creative people that are always trying to find some kind of validation, but not in a vain way, in a way to keep them sort of going, to keep the sword moving forward so they can put something better into the world. And, you know, I'm all for that, man.
I don't think that ever goes away. I don't know. I don't care how old you are. I think even Steven Spielberg in his
plus the
glory,
internet. I mean, whatever. Yeah. Like and grind, bro. Like you still need an individual that you respect, that you want to please,
right,
that says, attaboy.
If you get a five word sentence in a margin of a script that says keep going, you can live. That's your oxygen for like a year,
right? And that's, you know, having. I mean, okay, Tony. Like, let's talk about the dark side of validation, because, you know, I was lucky enough to get pretty much resounding good reviews for Greenlight. And I think that was entirely because of the love affair that people were having with Matt and Ben at the time. But I recently made a movie and I saw how other reviews are written. So how does it feel when you get recognition that people are writing about your work, but maybe the review is not necessarily the nicest? Like, how do you take it in stride?
I mean, you need like a thick skin. I'm sort of in between, somewhere between thin and thick. You know, I appreciate reviews that are, you know, that are smartly written and, you know, genuine about like what they feel, whether it's good or bad. I don't like snarky stuff. I have a problem with three people getting together and being snarky about something. I also think that there's power in somebody to, if there's four people in the room and three people all love something, I feel like there has to be somebody who says, it's great, but here's the problem. You know, you need to center for a second to sort of keep people going in the right direction. And I think smart reviews and smart critics will never trash something. I mean, it's hard to trash something unless it's complete shit. I mean, because there's a lot of people, and I know people who go to see the movies don't, they can care or they don't care about who's below the line or who's like behind the camera. But a lot of people work their ass off to actually get good shots and make something work. And if it doesn't cut at the end of the day, it's not everybody's fault. But the fact is, there's always something good about some movie where somebody tries. And like some of these filmmakers that you guys are going to have on the show and discuss, you know, through their wardrobe or whatever you want to call it, it's like there's always two movies that, okay, you know, they always rank worst to best kind of thing. And even some of the worst movies, there's something interesting in them. It's like somebody's trying for something. So I guess what I'm saying is like even certain, you know, sometimes the critic form is an art form. Like you have to sort of read between the lines and sort of think what's good and what they were sort of trying to say. And then there's, you know, the other critics that somehow just, you know, get on the Rotten Tomatoes line and they just trash something just to trash it. And I can say that because I've read so many different reviews about movies that I'm like, I didn't think that was that bad, you know?
Right.
And I also think that there's an industry in critics now.
Thank you again for joining us on How I Got Greenlit. We really appreciate you coming along for the ride. But before we go any further, I'd like to get a little serious with you all for a second. I know you've got plenty on your plate to think about these days, but something that affects all of us is the fact that Mother Nature is taking a beating these days. Wildfires, water shortages, and just plain weird weather are an unfortunate fact of life these days. The truth is, it's only going to get worse over the next few decades. So, you might ask yourself, what can we do? One thing we do is get educated. Next Chapter Podcast and the Clio Institute have teamed up on a podcast called House on Fire, co-hosted by Katrina Irwin, a 24-year-old climate activist, and Caroline Lewis, the founder of the Clio Institute. House on Fire is a youth-centered podcast that takes its name from Greta Thunberg's famous speech. It's youth-focused because, let's face it, us adults are leaving a pretty huge mess to clean up for the next generation. Each episode invites scientists, activists, artists, and more to have important conversations about this complex crisis. And the topics they cover could help you make decisions about how you might want to vote or spend your hard-earned money in the ways that leave behind a better world for those to come. So listen to House on Fire wherever you get your pods to stay informed and involved, or go to thecleoinstitute.org to learn more. Now, let's get back to How I Got Greenlit.
So, Tony, we got a good idea of how you got your personal green light. Most people, well, I know you from a lot of stuff, but I think the general audience is going to know you from your mega hit, The Shallows, made with our mutual friend, Maddie Lesham. Why don't you give us like, okay, so you're in the business, you're a working screenwriter, you're having some ups and downs, you've gotten some movies made, and you've gotten a reputation in the business. So tell us, did this start with an assignment? Did you do it with a spec? What was?
Well, there's different screenwriters, but there's different methods that screenwriters use. And I'm not a rewrite person. I'm generally like, you know, self, what do they call it? Like
self-generating.
Yeah. I've always been very, you know, fortunate to sell specs, and I've always stayed within the realm of thriller and horror, just because I think it's great drama. We've had this conversation before where, you know, it used to be the redhead stepchild horror, and now it's, you know, class A drama. It's all these sub genres of, you know, indie horror and, elegant horror and elevated horror and cultural horror. And I've just always liked the fact that it was exciting. So I wanted to do something with a shark. And
was this your South Florida upbringing? Did you have?
No, this is an interesting story because it sort of segues a little into Close Encounters, because I've always was a huge admirer of Duel. I think that's one of, you know, Steven's best films.
Agreed.
And I wanted to sort of figure out, after watching a week of Shark Week, how to make the shark kind of scary again, because there was all these shark cartoons and people punching sharks in the nose. And it used to be like, you know, sharks used to be, there was a threat. And how do you sort of take all the fat out of these movies that have sort of, you know, made these giant, these giant films out of a shark movie and streamline it again.
How do you take the shark back from the Sharknado, Tony?
Yeah, Sharknado is a good reference. And I was watching Duel that week too, and I put the two together. And I'd like to tell you it was my own idea and it was a brilliant sort of thing out of nowhere, but it was sort of like everybody has. Like, you take two ideas, you put them together, and like, oh, that would be really interesting. It's just one person versus a shark. How can you do that? And then, is there a Hitchcockian way to where you have set pieces and you're able to make this person survive and get back to a shore that she can see a mere 100, 200 yards away? And I thought there's something to that, but I was terrified about trying to write it because it would just come off as an hour long, Twilight Zone episode. It feels like I don't know if I could sustain that suspense for at least 85 minutes, but it all seemed to work out at the end. But I should tell you that the original script was in the deep, and it was a really hard R horror film. I mean, it had a bit of a darker ending, and it had some very graphic scenes. And I think Tom Rothman and, you know, the good people at Sony wanted to find a way to take a mild budget, you know, thriller and make it like sort of a summer movie that can go against, you know, the big Marvels of the world, but at the same time entertain people in kind of an accessible way. And I think that's where The Shallows kind of went at the end of the day. And I think at the end, I'm very proud of the movie. I think that I didn't expect the traction that it would get with young women. There's my niece and her friends that's one of their favorite movies of all time. And I never set out to make a movie. I'm very happy that young people have embraced this movie as one of their films, but I never set out to do that. I was looking to do kind of a scary, riveting shark movie and then sort of move on to the next thing, like sci-fi or what have you. But it's interesting when all those little things fall into place. And I think a lot of that comes to luck and timing and the good marketing of movies. But at the end of the day, I never know what a movie is going to end like at the end. And huge props to director, Jaume Colet-Serra for making this movie work the way it did, and for Maddie and Lynn. But that's part of the adventure too. It's like, how is this all going to edit at the end? And how does the page idea come out to be the film idea? And that's sort of the journey. So, I guess that's a long way of saying it. Well, that's sort of what broke me really into the bigger echelon of the business.
Let's be honest. You were a known assassin for a while. I mean, people.
Well, and a lot of writers are. I mean, that's sort of a good thing to emphasize, is that a lot of writers can go and do careers in this business for decades without even having something completely produced, because they're good rewrite artists or they produce good material. Sometimes it really is sort of luck of the draw if your movie comes out or if it doesn't come out. But I was in the business for quite a while, just writing scripts, and some scripts sell and some don't, but they sustain you to where you can make, you know, your your next month's rent. So that's good too.
Yeah, I mean, you had developed a niche, right? From Interstate, your first kind of horror thriller that mixed genres in this interesting way, you created a name brand for yourself. I mean, I've actually heard, you know, people say like, oh, it feels like a Tony Jaswinski thing. Like, you have a very smart, literate, but still genre sensibility that allows for mass appeal, but with characters that are very nuanced and emotionally balanced. It's almost like an indie character put into a bubblegum movie, or, you know, their sensibilities. So people want that. I mean, in the business, people, well, everybody, I think, but, you know, look, we could talk for hours about that, and that's entirely up to you. One question I just want to have in terms of translating page to picture. You had mentioned, because we've talked about this before, you and I, but for the audience, you know, you have a very spare style. It's there's a lot of white on the page, as they say, and your words are chosen very specifically, but you have almost like an artistic lilt. So you may write a line that's almost like literature to describe a scene or a way a character.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a few people sort of told me. It's very flattering. I think for me, I'm just a sparseness, maybe because I'm lazy, or I don't want to, or I've done the business for so long to where I know the first person that's going to read this is not going to be Tom Rothman. It's going to be the young executive junior or the assistant who's got to read, go through 20 scripts in the weekend. So I kind of want them to get them in and out at the same time, being able to check off all the boxes on the script that they like. So, you know, if I've heard some people tell me like, oh, you know, there's a Hemingway poet thing about your descriptions. And again, you know, I can't take a compliment. I think that's very flattering to hear, but that's just the way I sort of get from the first sentence to the end, because I just don't want to waste people's time in the read.
Yeah, and as Mark Twain once put it, you know, I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one. Which means that right. You're trying to be, you know, you're trying to be humble by saying you don't like writing many words, but if anyone out there has written prose and also written a screenplay, there is a trap that people fall in, like, oh, there's less words on the page. I could do a screenplay faster than a novel. But in fact, it's just a different art. It's almost like haiku. You have to fit a lot of ideas and nuances into really short, tight sentences. And there is an art to the layout of the page. I mean, a friend of mine, Scott Alexander, who's written a ton of stuff like People versus Larry Flynt, he says he actually does a draft, which is just page layout. Like, he just looks at it. And if it doesn't feel right, he'll cut a word, he'll add a return, he'll play with the formatting just so that the actual feel of the page looks balanced to him, every page. So there's something to it. But tell me, okay, so you've written this beautiful script and you've built this sort of like consensus among the suits and the artists and the producers and the money guys and whatever. How does... Was there a learning moment for you where, and I know this wasn't your first production of one of your films, but this was probably the biggest stakes. Was there a challenge to work with the producers, with the director? I mean, did you have a place at the table, or were they like, thank you?
Yes and no. This was a bigger movie in a way, and they shot most of or all of it in Australia. So they didn't buy my ticket to come out there, but they didn't want to set rewrite anyway. They pretty much wanted to be with the director, and I got the pleasure of watching my movie made across the street. And what that means is sometimes they'll drag you in whether you want to or not, and you have to be on set rewrites. And that's a whole new learning curve and whole new college too. And sometimes I know like a lot of writers complain like, oh, I should be on the set. And I don't know if you want to be. You know, it's really, I mean,
it's opening yourself up for a lot.
Yeah. And there's a huge anxiousness about it, you know, and then the directors look to you like, thanks for fucking that up because, you know, I can't get the scene working. And like, I can see why writers want to hide in Paris now, like when their scripts are getting made, because it can be really nerve wracking. I think that's why a lot of writers say, well, I want to be a producer on this too, just so, you know, I've been in the trenches and I've seen movies get made across the street. And I think that there's pros and cons for both, and there's highs for both too, but you definitely have, there's definitely like a tension about seeing your movie there and talking to the actors and trying to figure out, you know, what the end game is to motivations. Again, like I was telling you before, and I'll sort of let you, you know, go forward after this, but, there's one producer that I really trusted early on a movie, Christie, that this producer once told me, look, if you write an elephant in your script, they're going to have an elephant on the set, you know. And that happened with me when I created my first TV thing, and we had a pilot that we're shooting in Vancouver, and I wrote an elk because I'm so stupid and I've never been hunting in my life. And I thought an elk is the same thing as a deer's head. And they actually sent like a $6,000 giant elk head that can't go through a windshield. So I'll always remember, make sure that when you write elk, you want an elk. And that's another thing you learn when you're actually, you know, making a movie on a set as opposed to like writing it in your office or coffee shop or what have you.
Because an elk head shows up on set, it can't go through the windshield. So then the next hour is people scrambling around on all levels trying to find a deer head that can act. The antlers
can watch you for 48 hours after you made the wrong choice when you come into the office at 6 a.m. too. You
know? Right.
And props had to drive 3 states away to get the elk head because they had a deer head that was 10 minutes away.
Yeah, and then I had to call the guy up and try to get a half refund and made him feel really bad because he loved that elk and it took up a long time to get that elk head.
That's part one of our interview with writer Anthony Jaswinski. Next week, we continue our discussion about his career in film and television. We also talk about his love for the 1977 film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, starring Richard Dreyfuss, Francois Truffaut, and the incomparable Terry Garr. Thank you for listening. Join Alex Collegian and I next Tuesday on How I Got Greenlit.
Porn, Satan, drugs, therapy. It's not just the list of what I'm up to this weekend. I'm comedian Kiki Anderson, and those are just a handful of the taboo topics I've poked and prodded at so far on my podcast, Indecent, the show where we peel at the wallpaper of polite society. Each episode digs into the dark underbelly of our culture to dissect the things we aren't allowed to talk about around the dinner table, featuring conversations with comedians, activists, journalists, academics. They all help me figure out the who, what, and why behind what is and isn't acceptable behavior. Indecent with Kiki Anderson, where NSFW meets LMAO. Mwah.
Next Chapter Podcasts.